Hey, everybody. This episode of the Sex Nerd Sandra podcast is brought to you by AdamandEve.com. If you type in promo code SEXNERD at checkout, you get so many things. 50% off almost any item, free shipping, 3 free DVDs, and a super secret gift. And P.S., Adam and Eve sent me a magical box, and I opened it, and I got 3 items inside, and one of them was the head honcho. Now, the head honcho is a male masturbation sleeve. I did, in fact, ask for something on the male side, and I giggled because I've heard lots of great things about this toy, so now I have it. Now I just need to have a sexy friend slap it on and let me know what they think. So anyway, the head honcho is $27.95, and I thought it was cool that they sent me one, so I look forward to trying it out. Anyway, if you go to adamandeve.com, type in sex nerd at checkout to get 50% off almost any item, free shipping, 3 free DVDs, and that super secret gift. Ah, so many things. Ah, fun.
Now entering nerdist.com.
Welcome to the Sex Nerd Sandra podcast.
Whoa, what are these kids doing in here? Hey, if you're under 18, go ask your mom. Now that we're alone, let's start the show.
Hey, naughty monkeys. Hey, okay. So, we're about to go into an interview that is definitely pretty heady. And I have to say, I totally acknowledge some people aren't necessarily going to want to listen to this episode because this is a major jump away from the standard programming of this show, which is usually a little more fun, you know, have a good time. I mean, there are some laughs, definitely, but man, this is the episode where I really wanted to say, here are tools for you to give to yourself, your friends, the people that you love, for anyone who's dealt with sexual trauma, molestation, abuse, rape, whatnot, all of that, the darker side of sexuality. So, just let you know, that's where we're headed. But first, okay, I'm amazed that the week that the sexual trauma, sexual healing episode comes out, the Steubenville case is totally blown up. The conviction of the 2 teenage boys who are found guilty of raping the girl in Ohio. She had appeared deeply intoxicated. There were so many factors. There was partying going on, teenage revelry, people taking pictures, the social networking and the texting of things around this. How many people witnessed this violation and didn't do anything. The whole thing's a mess. The way the media has handled it is messy. The term rape culture is being thrown out a ton. I do have an issue with the term rape culture because I find that, I mean, it's identifying what it is. There is a culture of rape acceptance and a perception that at some point it's okay to take advantage of someone's body if they're intoxicated to a certain point. My issue with the term rape culture is really that the term itself kind of turns my mind off. I think because it's such a big concept and it deals with such fundamentals of how I've been socialized. And when I was on the Young Turks The Point show, which is a YouTube channel show, I saw so many comments where people were rejecting the concept of rape culture. And I think it's not taught enough as to what it really is. And so it's not necessarily helpful at this point culturally to be using that term as if people understand what it means. So, as an alternate, I just want to say something before we get to this episode, because it is a pretty heavy episode. No one gets to touch my butthole. No matter how drunk I am. I'm just going to put it out there. And I feel like no matter how drunk or asleep or naked you are, no matter what the context, even if we're at Burning Man, wherever, I don't get to touch your butthole until we have a consenting relationship where that's part of it. feel like all of this, the girl asked for it, she was wearing cute clothing, she was drinking a lot, none of that. I get it. Drinking and partying is a way to expand our boundaries, explore, maybe change it up, reduce our social norms a little bit, just free ourselves a bit. That means you get to explore your boundaries. That doesn't mean you get to push other people's boundaries. That's it, period. So I was just thinking about, we all have buttholes, I'm assuming. Maybe we should think about the fact that we don't get to touch each other's. Also, just on a related note, and during this episode, I will be admitting to certain things that have happened in my life. The fact that I am openly polyamorous and openly sex positive and a sex educator, it means that sometimes I'm in situations where people think it's okay to handle my body when it's not. Usually it's around friends. Usually it's around people who I'm chatting with, I'm laughing with, I'm partying with. And like the other week, I had someone grab my ass who I have never been physical with in my life. And it was just a joking comment, and then they grabbed me, and I stopped, and I said, oh my God, I feel violated right now, but am I not cool because I didn't like that? And I thought maybe it was me. That was the victim blaming herself. So, you know, moments after an uninvited ass grab, I'm thinking all these things in my head, and I let it go to a certain extent. I will most likely have a conversation with this person at some point. But if I think back into my life, I mean, you guys know me as a sex nerd Sandra. Sex is cool. Everything's fun. I look back, I've been sexually harassed. I've been manhandled by people. I lost a job once because I reported sexual harassment. I've been in situations where I felt my physical body was seriously under the threat of harm because someone found me attractive. I definitely lived a life of feeling like I am in danger. And it's not comfortable at all. Let me just let you know. And I know that some of you can totally relate to that. But I don't really think about it. And I'm finding a lot of empowerment in recent years. And I've found my voice, and I know how to say no and yes pretty loudly. And part of this show is about finding sexual health, finding emotional health in ourselves, and feeling comfortable in our own skin. So with that, I realized I was a little bit of a diatribe. I love you guys. Next week, P.S., I'll be talking to James Dean, porn star, sexy man, dynamo extraordinaire, goofy guy. Had a lot of fun with him. So that'll be next week. Yay, lighthearted. For now, enjoy the show. Hey, monkeys. Hey. Hello. Welcome. Yes, every week we cover a different topic on the Sex Nerd Sandra podcast, and this week is going to be a topic that I've been nervous about for a while, and I found a fantastic guest to have on to talk about this, but this is a little warning. We are going to be talking about sexual abuse, molestation, trauma this episode. What that means is you might experience intense feelings, discomfort, triggers. You may have to pause, and maybe you'll be fine. I'm already feeling like intensely like excited about finding out what we're about to find out, but at the same time scared because I know that this is triggering for me. So just know that I'm facing those awkward feelings, and it's okay if you're facing them too, but you can pause, you can go away, you don't have to listen to this episode at all. Skip forward. Next week, I'm sure, is going to be a blast. But for now, it's just to make sure that you take care of yourself, because this is one of those times where we need to do that. Kate, do you have any extra warning and check-ins for people?
Well, I would just say that if you find yourself being triggered, but you do want to listen to this podcast, just listen to it in bits, you know, turn it off for a little bit and find a way to calm yourself, whether that's meditation or deep breathing or hugging your teddy bear, whatever it is that makes you happy. And then listen to it a little bit more and just track your body and notice what you're feeling and stop when you need to.
Yeah, and lots of deep breaths, I think. Like, I'll be taking a lot of deep breaths. Hey, hi, Kate. Okay, so, yeah, I've gotten emails from lots of sex nerds who are in relationships with people or who have themselves experienced sexual trauma, abuse, molestation, violence of different sorts, and how that affects their love lives and their sex lives. And I am not trained in that at all. So I am completely, I am completely clueless as to how to handle that. I mean, I've got my like instincts, but I'm not trained in that. And that's something that like we need professionals to handle. So I've brought in Kate Lurie, a licensed psychotherapist in the LA area, to talk about this. And I have to say, before even we get to it, like I myself have dated and been in partnership with someone who was abused as a child, and I did not know how to handle it. And there was no support. Like, they weren't in therapy. They didn't have anyone to lean on. And I didn't know if they had processed it in a healthy way. And there was just no way to tell. And it was a while ago. And why didn't we have the tools to be able to thrive and empower ourselves to take care of each other in that situation? So welcome to the microphone, Kate Lurie.
Thank you, Sandra. I'm so happy to be here. So
tell us everything. No, first, tell listeners a little bit about yourself, because we've known each other for a while and I didn't realize that you had this training, and I'm so excited that you agreed to come on and share with us what you know. Maybe we can figure it out. But yeah, I know you have a private practice. Like, tell us a little bit about stuff.
Okay, so basically regarding this topic in particular, I've been working with people that have sexual abuse for about over a decade. And I started out even when I was in school working with little munchkins that had gone through sexual molestation. I think that was some of the more challenging work. I mean, because you fall in love with these little clients and they're so sweet, and sometimes you can't save them from the situation that they're in entirely. So that's kind of where I started. These days I work in a hospital and I do groups with people with different kinds of backgrounds, but a lot of them have trauma. A lot of them have sexual molestation histories. And so I work with a team that helps them heal from that. And then I also have a private practice where I have a lot of clients that also have sexual abuse or, you know, different trauma. But I also have a specialty in working with people in alternative lifestyles. So that's a second focus that I have, because I guess my purpose in life is to reduce sexual shame. And so both of those areas help me achieve that goal.
Yeah, I've admired you for a long time because there aren't enough therapists to help, to be available and welcoming to people in alternative sexual lifestyles. So, I mean, just in that way, you're a rock star.
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. It's like, duh, you're cool. So to add on to that, that you've also done this work is like, Kate Lurie, favorite person.
Well, thank you. You know, I just feel like I've had friends in my private life, you know, that have gone through this and who didn't have support. And I'm so glad that I work at a hospital where I work with a lot of professionals.
Okay, so just so people know, if they are shopping around for a therapist in their area, you were describing to me before that there are different types of models that a therapist can be trained in when working with clients with sexual molestation in their past. So can you just outline those just so people know the difference when they're looking out there in the world?
Yeah, there's two main types that I believe are really beneficial, and all the research shows that they have been effective. One is EMDR and the other one is somatic psychotherapy. To find out more about EMDR, you can go to EMDRIA. Just type in EMDRIA, and you can, and if you Google that, you'll be able to find the EMDRIA website. And then with somatic psychotherapy, there's different types, but the one that I've been trained in is the trauma resiliency model, and that is provided through the Trauma Resource Institute. So if you type in their name, you can find out information about that model. and therapists. And both websites give information about therapists who have been trained in those areas. So if you have had trauma, either one of those models is really beneficial to help you heal. And if you find a therapist that has both, then you're really hooking up with a good therapist. But again, at the end of the day, it's not just the model that the therapist knows. It's whether you have a good sense and feel safe with that therapist.
Okay. This topic can be a total bummer, but also I'm so realistic because it permeates so many people's past experiences, and it is something, it's an element to consider. It would be silly of me as a sex educator to just kind of go like, oh yeah, like just have fun, when really people have, I mean, our pasts, like the baggage and the joys that we carry with us, that affects our current state. So, Kate, you just pointed out on that you had just posted something on your Facebook fan page about just how, just in terms of, okay, can I just read this?
Sure.
Can I just read off your page? Okay. According to the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network, one out of every six American women has been the victim of an attempted or completed rape in her lifetime. About 3% of American men have experienced an attempted or completed rape in their lifetime. 54% of sexual assaults go unreported to the police. And 97% of rapists never spend a day in jail. And this is just considering, like, rape. It's also, not everything is penetrative, necessarily. And not everything is reported even to this network. So it's a part of people's lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, basically, you know, most people have probably either experienced molestation or rape, or at least they know somebody. You know, they probably know several people that have experienced it. They may not be aware, but just by having an open stance and being non-judgmental and being supportive of your friends, you can allow people to be more open with you and supportive. And, you know, basically you'll find out that there's a lot of people out there that need love and support that have gone through this.
Surprisingly, there is this myth that many people cry wolf, when the truth is that is very rare when that actually happens.
Mm-hmm. You know, as a family member or a friend, there's things that you can do to support someone who discloses to you that they've been molested or raped. And one thing is just to believe them. You know, just believe them, because there's a lot of people that they've probably told that haven't, or have questioned it, or have asked them if in some way did they, you know, encourage it. And so just believing them can be a big help. And then also not placing any shoulds on them, like not telling them, well, you need to forgive, or you need to get over it. Mm-hmm. If you can just do those three things, mm-hmm. then you are way ahead of the game in terms of being a loving family member or friend.
Mm-hmm. God. That is, like, I get mad because, like, even, like, after a breakup, people go, well, it's been 2 months, you should already be over this. Or, like, people, like, assume how you should be after something negative in your life. And so, like, something as traumatic as that, it's like, you know, you're going to be just right where you are, and you just need to be there and not pressure yourself to have to, you know, to be somewhere different.
Exactly. And what often happens to people that have survived either rape or prolonged molestation is that because other people pressure them in that way, and because they are pressuring themselves in that way, they put the trauma in a box somewhere, and they might go for years just not being in touch with how it's affecting them. And then one day maybe it comes out, you know, and it's so much healthier to find support either through friends or connect with a group or a therapist that can help you, or all of that.
Dude, I mean, I hate to, because this isn't something that necessarily comes up in just everyday conversation. This isn't one of those pleasantries, you know, that people have, like, at brunch. But I was with someone earlier today, a casual acquaintance, hanging out. I'm like, oh yeah, I'm going to interview this therapist later on this subject. And they're like, oh yeah, that permeates, like, a lot of people's lives. I'm like, oh yeah, like, well, yeah. That's part of my past. I'm like, really? And then they were, and then we started to get into this conversation. I would have never known that this person was a survivor of abuse, and they were just so wonderful to answer my questions. And truly, I was like, how is this playing out now? Because they have a partner. And for them, it's like they were numb for years. Like they couldn't even feel their body in places.
And that's one of the first things that a survivor can do to help heal themselves. You know, that's a big part of somatic psychotherapy, is teaching a person that they can safely start to live in their body. Because a lot of people with trauma, they start to just live in their head. Their body is not safe. Their body is the enemy. But in fact, their body is the key to helping them heal. And so if they can start to slowly get in touch with their body, and at first they might not be able to. At first they may be like, what? You want me to track my body? My body just feels dead to me. Mm-hmm. But after a while, they can do that. And by tracking their body, they can notice when they don't feel safe. They can notice when they do feel safe. And then they can start to pull themselves out of triggering situations, and they can build on situations that make them feel safer in this world. And so that becomes very powerful in the healing process.
So they start expanding their safe zone slowly, and they know where they can play and where they can't play. Yeah, dude. I keep saying dude, like, dude. I don't know why. I'm so professional. Yeah, it's like they were saying earlier today, there was a door in their mind that was locked and they didn't have the key. And then there's this barrier and they just can't get in there, and there's just something stuck. And they've been through therapy and whatnot. And just, it blows my mind, because, like, sometimes I feel incredibly disconnected from my body. Mm-hmm. And I fortunately do not have a past of child abuse. I mean, I had a safe, my body was my temple as a child. No, that doesn't even make sense. Like, I don't have a past of sexual abuse.
I actually say that all the time. I always tell people, you know, your body is your temple to decorate and to honor and to take care of. You know, I'm always using that analogy, actually.
Okay, cool. All right. I hit a good one. All right, I'm fine. I'm fine. Yeah, I'm doing all right.
I like it.
Yeah, because I'm nervous. I am nervous right now, because it's like, oh, be good. Be a good sex educator. Yeah, so my experience, when we're talking about this, because I was trying to debate with you before we started, what is this covering? This is covering anyone who's had either violence or molestation in their past. It could have been as an adult, as a child, just a negative thing that's still affecting them in their life. Or maybe they're not even sure if it's still affecting them, but something that mm-hmm. clearly is a big footprint in their memory.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of this will apply to someone who's maybe been, you know, raped. We haven't been talking so far about someone who's actually in crisis, where rape has happened, like last week. If you recently had a rape, then of course, you know, there's different things that would apply. Like, you need to go to a hospital immediately, ideally within 24 hours. You need to call the police. You need to get a huge support wraparound network for yourself, ASAP. That's a whole other topic, you know, but the important thing is to get as big of a support network, to contact the police, and to get yourself to a hospital if you've been recently raped.
Okay. That's actually a great segue to, because we're going to talk about the hope and the healing, but what are some things that happen when, okay, I knew someone in high school who told me that one of our mutual friends had been raped at a party, by several members of a sports team, right? Mm-hmm. And I was like, is this person going to report that? Is this person going to do anything about that, or like seek help? And she was like, no, she's not doing anything. Like, she just sort of accepted, like, oh, she was drinking and that happened. And I was like, you know, and all these red flags are going off, but it didn't feel like my place to do anything. And it boggled my mind at the time that someone could experience violence, and not reach out and report and get the help they need. What keeps people from moving forward and seeking, some might say, seek justice and mm-hmm. take care of themselves?
Mm-hmm. That's a huge question, and there's many answers to it. I'll try and list some of them. Basically, a lot of it is shame. A lot of it is feeling that you won't get the support, that you won't be believed, that in some way it was your fault. You know, a lot of survivors, if on any level, you know, they felt like they put themselves in that situation, they feel like it was their fault. And it's not true. You know, it's not your fault if you've been molested or raped. You are a beautiful soul just on your own. And if someone abused your temple, uh-huh. then, You know, you deserve to be able to get the support you need. You deserve to be able to reach out and tell people. And it's a shame that in our society, people fear that they won't be believed, that people will tell them to get over it, what have you. And if we can start to heal as a society, then our survivors will feel more comfortable coming out and trying to seek out help. And they won't fear that they will be shunned or told that they're bad. They already feel like they're bad a lot of times, which, of course, is not the case.
Yeah. Hmm. You know, it's... I feel fortunate to not have had, like, any severe, like, rape or abuse in my past. I had a really interesting experience, though. This was, like, I was in my early 20s. I had driven up and parked at my boyfriend's house. It was, like, 3 a.m. We'd had a fight. I had gone out dancing with my girlfriend, so I was in, like, this cute little outfit, like, this silky little skirt and, like, high heels. But I wanted to, like, you know, and I knew that he stayed up really late, and it was kind of a bad part of town. And I'd only parked around the corner, and I got out of my, or I was sitting in my car, like, trying to text him, and I get a knock on the window, and it's some guy, and he's trying to, like, get me to talk to him, and it's like, go away. So I sat in my car, and I watched him walk around the corner, and then finally when he was gone, I got out to walk to the gate to the apartment building. Well, as I'm waiting for my boyfriend to come down, I suddenly hear someone running at me, and the guy is, like, running at me. Mm-hmm. And he, like, shoves me up against the wall and, like, just fondles my body. And, like, I mean, it's fucking terrifying, you know, just, like, being stalked. I had no idea how terrifying it is to have someone hunting you. Mm-hmm. Like, in the middle of the night. Oh, it was terrifying. Like, I couldn't even. So anyway, he, like, is, like, handling me. But then, like, of course, I'm, like, I will kick your ass, you know? So, like, I'm immediately, like, pushing him off and whatnot. And he just runs away. Like, it's just a middle of the night thing. Mm-hmm. Luckily, that's all it was, but it was still, like, incredibly violating to my body. Mm-hmm. Extremely stressful. I mean, by the time my partner came down and thought that I was upset because we'd had a fight, and I was like, open this fucking gate right now, because I'm outside, and, you know. We ended up calling the police, and they were wonderful. Like, the police were wonderful, and they really felt for me, and I was like, oh, this is what it's like when the authorities care. Mm-hmm. You know, and I sought help, and, like, and I healed, and I'm fine, like, but the feeling is I was dressed up, and I looked cute, and I was in a short skirt, and I was in heels, and I was in a bad part of town. But that doesn't fucking mean that that's an invitation to do anything to my body, you know? Like, and I can see how someone can feel like that would possibly put some of the blame on them. And I can understand that, but it doesn't. It doesn't mean anyone is invited to touch you and do anything to you. And, like, that was, for me, an important experience for me to, like, understand that weird line people can have, you know?
Yeah. You know, your story makes me think of several things, but one, you know, as far as survivors go, part of my goal is to help you keep feeling restricted and having to stay in a box to attempt to keep yourself safe, and help you to be expansive. And that includes, as a woman, feeling sexy and being able to wear pretty things and not think that you have to wear something dumpy in order to stay safe. You know, it's not about that. This is somebody who is acting in a way that is, you know, abusive and horrible. It has nothing to do with whether you wore a pretty dress or not. The other thing that I hear in your story is that you fought back. Mm-hmm. Now, most people, or most animals even, if you look at the animal kingdom, if an animal is attacked, they will either fight, as you did, mm-hmm. run, or freeze like a possum, you know? And most humans have a default. They have a tendency to lean towards a couple or one or two of those parts. They might initially freeze and then run, or there can be different combinations. If you fight, studies show that you are less traumatized. But you don't get to choose that. In a moment, our brain, our you know, lizard brain or reptilian brain reacts. It's not a conscious choice. You didn't choose to fight, probably. Mm-hmm. Just like the person who freezes did not choose to freeze.
Well, okay, like, if you look at, like, my past, one, wrestling in high school was wonderful for me. I think everyone should have some sort of body contact sport, something where you learn that how to move with another person, mm-hmm. and handle them, and plus it's fun. But when I was 12, I was in middle school. I mean, of course, I'm mainly expressing this as sort of my own illustrations of like a life and like my experiences, for because, you know, we've all had these different experiences. A kid who was only like 13 at the time bullied me after school, mm-hmm. and kind of like said really mean things about like the way I looked and whatnot. And people, like, I'm around cool people generally, so it was like really startling for him to be that abusive. And we were alone, like in some hallway, and he like pushed me up against the wall and like slapped me. And I had frozen. Like, I had no idea how to handle it. And that's all that, like, and like, of course, me, I'm like, I go immediately to a counselor and I'm like, dude, that's fucked up. You know, and like, I was like, immediately sought help and counseling, and the mm-hmm. guy was like suspended. And apparently, I had been like the 10th person he'd like done this to. And finally, mm-hmm. something had happened. So great. Yay for us. But I learned that I freeze. So then from there, I learned to be more, to snap out of it faster, which is important for, like, you know, mm-hmm. if you're...
That's an important thing to mention, is that you can train your body mm-hmm. to have a better chance of reacting differently, mm-hmm. you know, by taking a self-defense course or by learning to track your body. The more you track your body,
the... What does that mean?
Just note it, like, I mean, I could go on a long explanation, but basically just noticing when your heart rate is going up or when your heart is down, you know, when you're breathing deep or shallow, when your sympathetic nervous system has kicked in.
It's the fight or flight stuff.
Exactly. You will probably be breathing rapid and shallow. Your body will probably be tense. Mm-hmm. There's different things that go on in the body. When your sympathetic nervous system goes online.
And dude, my sympathetic nervous system gets triggered when I watch a Tarantino film. Like, Inglourious Basterds, like, I went into shock.
Yeah, but you can, even with those movies, you can train your body to calm down. Mm-hmm. You want to get your parasympathetic nervous system back online. You can do that in different ways, like by deep breathing or by thinking of a positive resource. And when I say a positive resource, I mean anything that when you think about it, you notice your body calming down, your breathing's getting easier.
This is good also just for people who are like nervous on a date. You know, like these, yes. This is like, you mean like think about my mom or like think about chocolate? Like what is, like what are common?
It would be individual to you.
Okay.
Like for some people, it might be their favorite song, mm-hmm. or it might be a beach vacation they went on. The important thing is to think of a resource that doesn't flip on you. Like you might really love your grandma and be like, oh, that's my resource. But if it quickly switches to the fact that she died last year, mm-hmm. that's not a good resource. Okay. You want something that you can stick with and that can keep your body calm.
This is almost like that joke that you see in movies and things where it's like, my happy place, find my happy place. But it really is like, find your happy place.
Yes. Well, by finding your happy place and not just thinking of it for a second, mm-hmm. but really fleshing it out in your mind with all your five senses and tracking your body, noticing that your breathing's getting easier, noticing that your heart rate is slowing down and really sticking with it in an almost meditative way, mm-hmm. you can not only calm yourself down, that you can start rewiring your neural networks in your brain.
Oh yeah, tell me about that brain stuff. So hot. Always getting
it. Anyway. But if you ever watch What the Bleep Do You Know, that film actually talks about those kind of things, that when you get in touch with positive resources, that you are grooving in new neural pathways. Mm-hmm. When you have a trauma, there's negative neural pathways that are grooved in that get you either what's called stuck on high or stuck on low. Stuck on high, and this is trauma resiliency model talk mm-hmm. right now. Stuck on high is basically feeling like you're having a panic attack, having road rage, feeling really anxious. You know, that's all stuck on high. Stuck on low, which a lot of trauma survivors also experience, is feeling dissociated, out of your body, in your head. Feeling like you're floating on the ceiling somewhere and you're not in your body anymore. That's all stuck on low stuff.
Oh my God. I feel like I'm stuck on low just generally. Kate, fix me.
Well, you know, it's all of this stuff, you know, we can all do, you know, I do it, you know, you can do it. We can all, it's simple things that you can do to get yourself calmed down in terms of getting yourself grounded in your body, tracking your body, building positive resources. you know.
Life skills, man. Seriously.
Yep.
You're amazing because I walked in this fabulous red office of yours and you have a list of things that people can do to empower themselves toward healing. Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, some of the things we've actually already covered, you know, finding your voice. You know, you gave the example of your friend who wasn't going to report what happened to her with it sounded like a gang rape. You know, it's so important to find your voice. And finding your voice might not mean making a report and going through a court case. That might be re-traumatizing for you. Finding your voice might mean, you know, talking to friends or finding support, or it might mean privately having your own journey, learning how to be assertive. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of survivors get to a point where they don't, they have a tendency to start acting in a way that's kind of victim-y just in the way they relate to the world. They have a tendency, some survivors, to be very passive. Mm-hmm. And so learning how to be assertive is one step towards healing. Mm-hmm. So in general, finding your voice is a good first step.
I will say one thing, though. I mean, having, and I've known people who were survivors of sexual abuse. One thing that can get really awkward, and I'm almost laughing because it can be so awkward, is when someone's finding their voice. They sometimes will overshare, like sort of out of nowhere, just to like feel empowered, like they can say it and it's no longer a secret. But then they choose to say it like 5 minutes into a work shift to a coworker, and it's like really triggering for the next person because they did not expect that. Like to find out the intimate details of their child abuse of their past. And it's so it's also in the awkwardness that can be the adolescence of finding your voice. Mm-hmm. It's maybe understanding that you can't just emotion vomit to anyone necessarily.
Well, you're actually bringing up a much deeper issue, which is that survivors have a tendency, a lot of them, to either shut down and be very passive, or sometimes when they do start to talk, they do something called flooding, and they'll do this sometimes with a therapist. When a person, not just a trauma survivor, starts talking about anything that's painful in their life, well, especially trauma survivors, they have a tendency to do something called flooding. Mm-hmm. The way our brain works, when we start to connect with a trauma, our brain starts just connecting every trauma that ever happened in our life. And people have a tendency to just want to go through kind of an emotional vomit of trauma after trauma. And unfortunately, that's just re-traumatizing. That's not helpful. Flooding is not helpful. And part of what the perpetrator teaches is poor boundaries. And so, you know, part of healing as a survivor is to learn boundaries.
Okay.
And learn how to protect yourself.
Right, right. Because before we started recording, you were describing that it's not just violence, it's also coercement, it's also being groomed possibly by someone to feel, to just blur those boundaries of what's acceptable for like a familial relationship. Mm-hmm. You know? So, yeah.
So as an adult, sometimes as an adult, or even as a teenager, you know, an abuse survivor will start to act out. Some abuse survivors might not be able to protect their body, and so they end up being used sexually by other people that aren't necessarily quote-unquote perpetrators. They just might be boys or girls that kind of take advantage of someone who's vulnerable, you know?
Yeah.
And so that's one reason it's so important to track your body so that you can in turn notice when you need to protect yourself and assert a boundary, you know? So let's see. So we talked about some of these, learning to be in your body, learning to track body sensations, learning to ground your body, building positive resources, and developing a sense of boundaries and learn to assert boundaries. Befriending your inner child is one that we haven't talked about.
Befriending your inner child?
Yes.
Wait. Yeah, that sounds like something fun.
Well, it's mixed. Part of it is fun.
Okay.
But part of it is very difficult. You know, sometimes for survivors, the part of themselves that they like the least, which is oftentimes the part of themselves that holds the pain, they almost wish they could cut it off, like cutting off a finger or something. They'd like to be rid of it. But actually, that's probably the part that needs the most love and understanding. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that is part of the inner child. You know, it's that part of yourself, that really needs to be nurtured and loved and needs to be held.
What's an example of that? Like the part of self, like my vulnerability or my...
Mm-hmm. We all, to a degree, some of us more than others, we all have kind of ego states. Mm-hmm. You can probably think about how you are when you're on your podcast versus how you are when you're with a boyfriend or someone you're dating. You slightly switch, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I hate the version of me that's on the podcast. Guys, just for the record, like... All my friends have pointed out, like, you're way funnier off the podcast. Like, I'm trying to be more comfortable on this damned fucking podcast. Ah! So, yeah, but okay. Enough about me. I'm flooding.
So we all, to a degree, have ego states. Uh-huh. But some people, it's much more extreme. Like, for some folks that have extreme sexual molestation through a large part of their lives, they might even have multiple personalities with... what's called amnestic barriers, where one personality doesn't remember the other. Uh-huh. And other people might have personalities where they do, they can start to talk to the different personalities. Mm-hmm. Like the more adult personality can actually write letters to the younger personality. Yeah. So there's levels for people that have multiple personalities or dissociative identity disorder. There's levels to that. Mm-hmm. I've worked with quite a few people with many personalities. And honestly, I think, you know, a lot of people think Michael Jordan or Clint Eastwood mm-hmm. is our heroes. Honestly, I think some of those people are our heroes. They're so courageous in their very creative way of coping with horrific abuse that sometimes started when they were babies, you know.
Whew. Yeah, wow. Okay.
And so they have the most developed inner children. They might have literal children altars mm-hmm. That are within them. And one way to reach them is through art. Mm-hmm. Like their artwork usually, in my experience, is amazingly creative. These are usually very intelligent, creative people. And they can make artwork that really helps them process the trauma and also to kind of have a conversation sometimes with the different alters. It's kind of like a family inside your body. And yeah. The family needs to get around the table and start mm-hmm. to work together.
Right. To become a whole person again instead of being fractured.
Well, that might not be, you know, a lot in the old school therapy was the thought that the goal was to integrate. Mm-hmm. But actually, that can make some of the alters feel like you're trying to kill them off.
Oh.
They don't like that.
Oh.
And so it's better to think of the round, you know, like the King Arthur round table example, where you're just trying to get the different alters to have a conversation with each other and to get along and to try and find some kind of agreement mm-hmm. and work together. Mm-hmm. And that can help them function in the world.
Yeah. Just in storytelling, like, because when you're... Like, you have art in this office that's very beautiful, that's from patients. And, like, for me, like, I just did the storytelling show, and I learned that instead of writing out a story, which is awful for me, like, it's the worst using words, because, when like, from my experiences are embedded in a way where I can't necessarily verbally express them. I have a really hard time with my stories. I feel a lot of them. I am a very emotional person, so to tell a story means to bring up a lot of emotions that I'm not necessarily comfortable with. But I found Dixie, who runs Body Storytelling, taught me that I can draw pictures. And so now I'll storyboard a story. And so when you talked about art therapy, I realized, oh, like, there is something to drawing your experiences instead of talking about your experiences. And that unlocks them. And I had no idea. Mm-hmm. Like, it's like a brain hack, you know, and you're mm-hmm. like, it's like, yeah, figure it out.
So that's one thing that I've been doing for over a decade is art psychotherapy. And, you know, it's one of those things that people get really nervous because most people have had some teacher that, you know, said color in the lines. And, you know, mm-hmm. a lot of people have shame around art. But, you know, this is not about judgment. It's not about mm-hmm. grades. It's just a way to express yourself. And, you know, when you think about a comedian, think about what a comedian gets away with saying.
Yeah.
You know, they get to, well, art therapy is the same way. There's things that you can say that you might not want to verbally speak. Mm-hmm. And so for a lot of people, they're able to process through sexual abuse that might be shameful for them to talk about. Or, you know, other things that are hard, you know, they might not be quite ready to say out loud. Mm-hmm. They can process through art psychotherapy, and it's very powerful, and I love doing it. Mm-hmm. It's amazing work. No. So,
no, it's good to get beyond words sometimes.
Absolutely.
What else? What else?
let's see. Well, one thing that's important is, you know, to get in touch with your triggers.
Oh, right.
You know, when you think of the trauma that you had, your triggers could be smells. They could be certain types of touches. It could be the ceiling fan in your bedroom. You know,
yeah.
There's so many different things. If you think about being in a grocery line and all of a sudden you smell the guy in front of you and he's wearing Old Spice and all of a sudden you're about to have a panic attack, you might think you're going crazy, mm-hmm. when really it might be that your perpetrator was wearing Old Spice and you're getting triggered, yeah. and therefore having a panic attack. And it's actually perfectly understandable. So really listing your triggers and then trying to either change your space or, you know, work with your partner to make things less triggering, mm-hmm. is very important.
Do you like necklaces and chokers and things? Like, for instance, like the BDSM, mm-hmm. Communication part of it is which areas of your body are you not comfortable me touching? Because, like, choking, if you put anything around the neck on somebody who'd had a neck trauma, I mean, that's a huge trigger for some people. You can't touch their neck.
Right.
And that's severely important to respect and to acknowledge in a person, especially if you're making out with them.
You know? Yeah. And that's one thing for a partner. You know, if you're in a relationship, it can be very hard for the partner to be in a relationship with someone that's had sexual abuse. The partner sometimes, the person that's been sexually abused sometimes projects aspects of the perpetrator onto their partner. So if the partner instigates sex, for instance, that may feel similar to what, you know, the perpetrator who always foisted themselves on them. And so as a partner, it's really important if you have someone that's still very severely traumatized to always let them initiate sex. And in fact, you might even want to take a sex vacation for a while and just relearn touch, starting out with non-sexual touch. Mm-hmm. Wait until your partner gets to a point mm-hmm. where they can handle non-sexual touch and then work up, you know, progressively and slowly. Mm-hmm. You know, with partner relationships, you know, like a vacation from sex, some researchers say at least 3 months, mm-hmm. 3 months to a year. And again, setting boundaries within the relationship, finding out, you know, what is comfortable for your partner can be really difficult to realize that the person that's been sexually abused needs to hold the reins, mm-hmm. you know, especially if you're used to holding the reins yourself.
Since we've transitioned to talking about partner stuff, I was just talking to someone who is partnered with someone with sexual abuse in their past, and I could see, and I'd asked him, like, is this the first time you've dated someone like that? He's like, no, this is like the third person I've dated who's had sexual trauma. And I go, okay, so it seems like you're trying to save her. And they're like, yeah, well, yeah. And I'm like, is she seeking out any help? No. So, like, it bothers me when a partner finds themselves in a position where they're trying to save or heal the person who, you know, they try and be the hero,
mm-hmm.
when I see that it tends to just be exhausting for that person.
Right. So the person that's the partner might end up feeling very alone, sad. They might end up feeling that their needs aren't being met. You know, basically the partner is a secondary victim. Mm-hmm. They're in this too. And if the relationship is going to work, they have to heal together. Mm-hmm. A lot of times the partner has a hard time, you know, their own stuff might get triggered. Yeah. When the sexual abuse person says, you know, I just don't want to have sex tonight, the partner might end up feeling rejected. They might end up feeling disgust, you know, that they're disgusting. And they have to realize, you know, this isn't about them. And they have to realize that sometimes their partner that's been sexual abused might be projecting stuff onto them, and they need to be able to say to themselves, you know what, I'm healthy sexually, and I'm able to hear when they need to stop, and I'm able to hear what their triggers are. Because once you start having communication, not just in the bedroom, but you know, in and out of the bedroom. Mm. Then you can start learning what the triggers are, and then you can start to have some power within the relationship. Mm. But in, you know, if you're still in a place where you're feeling rejected and you're reacting in a defensive way, mm-hmm. you know, then your partner that's been sexually abused is going to fear that you can't handle it, you know, that you're going to reject them, and they're going to keep this stuff locked up inside. And in turn, the cycle continues because mm-hmm. abuse, you know, and not that the partner is abusing them, but the original abuse thrived in secrecy.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like emotional transparency.
Yes.
Sounds like a building block for healing.
Exactly. Which is easier said than done. That's really hard to listen to your partner who's been sexually abused. They might have a lot of triggers and it might be really hard. You might feel like you're walking on eggshells, especially in the beginning. But if you're able to do that and hold that space, there is, you know, healing is possible mm-hmm. and you can regain intimacy in your relationship and you can regain a sexual connection as well. But you have to have a lot of patience.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like it would be best if the person also had a support network of like a mental health professional for them to go to. Like if
both people should ideally be in therapy. Because, okay. you know, as I said, you know, they're in it together. I mean, the ideal situation, which you'd have to have a lot of money to do, is for both to have individual therapy and to be doing couples work as well. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, this isn't just about one person's work.
Okay.
It's what's the interaction between the two of them.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, noticing what the survivor's triggers are, but also noticing what your triggers are mm-hmm. is important. And then, you know, trying to get past the anger and, you know, just, you know, voicing your other emotions and voicing the sadness or being at least able to handle the anger and realize a survivor's going to be freaking angry. They've got a lot to be angry about.
Yeah.
And sometimes that anger will get lashed out at you. And if you communicate through it, then you can reach a deeper place of intimacy.
Yeah.
But it's not easy work. And just because you're not able to do it does not mean that you're a failure or anything like that. But these are the things that are necessary.
Dude, emotional awareness is so important. And, like, even for me, I'm still tapping in. You know, it's like, a slow process. But, like, I'm remembering a time when I had been trying to deal with whatever situation or love life thing was going on. And I remembered how angry I was. But the point where I realized it was okay to feel anger and then let myself feel anger and, like, crazy. I can remember just calling someone and being like, I'm so pissed. Like, and just telling my friend, like, wow, I'm pissed. I'm so pissed. I'm the pissiest kind of pissed. Like, and just, like, because you spend so much energy repressing your shit. Mm-hmm. And then when you mm-hmm. let it out, you're like, dude, woo-hoo-hoo.
Yeah. And so if you're a survivor or a partner of a survivor, then part of your work is to figure out, okay, well, I can't just put my anger in a box. How can I get out my anger in a way that doesn't jack me up further, but actually relieves me?
Mm-hmm.
For some people, just pushing on a wall, ideally a wall that has some good foundation behind it so you don't, you know, push a hole in your wall, but, you know,
don't break things unless you can pay for the stuff.
But honestly, you know, pressing on a wall and just yelling whatever you want to get out, that can really, you know, help, you know, allow you to have a release, allow yourself to cry if that's what you need to do. It's okay. And after all the crying and after the release, you probably will be able to get back into your resilient zone,
mm-hmm.
you know? And if not, you know, again, hopefully you're in therapy. Hopefully, you know, if you find that you're still triggered, you know, call up your therapist and, mm-hmm. and have a session and let them help you get grounded again.
Yeah. What else do we have on this legal pad of life skills?
Okay, well, one thing, you know, when you do catch yourself being triggered, there's things that you can do. You know, when you're getting triggered, again, you're getting into a place where your reasoning part of your brain may not be as online, you know, your cortex.
Mm-hmm.
And when your sympathetic nervous system kicks in, your cortex kind of doesn't completely go offline, but partially, that's your reasoning part of your brain.
Nina Hartley was on a while ago, and she talked about how, like, where it goes from your front lobes to, like, the reptilian brain. Like, there's a 3-step process, and, like, when you
She's talking about the triune brain.
Yeah, and I can't remember the three parts.
The cortex, the limbic system, and then, you know, there's your reptilian brain. Mm-hmm. Some people like to call it the lizard brain.
Right.
Yeah, when you're in that lizard brain place, that's when you're going into fight, flight, or freeze a lot of times. That's when you're in a fight with your partner, things come out of your mouth where the next day you're just like, oh, damn it, why the hell did I say that, you know? So when you get triggered, to just stop and become aware that you're triggered. And again, try and get in touch with some resources. So calm yourself, whatever that means, whether that means taking a walk. Sometimes climbing some stairs can be great to calm your body and get rid of some of that energy. Whatever that means for you, everybody has a different way to calm yourself. And then one thing that's important is to affirm that you are in the present. You are not back when the abuse happened. The abuse happened in 1968 or what have you. You're not in 1968. You're in 2013. Notice your surroundings, the things, you know, whatever's comforting to you on the walls or whatever. And then choose a new response to the trigger. Mm-hmm. So that might mean removing the trigger from the room. Like if it's the ceiling fan, get a different ceiling fan or put
fucking punch that ceiling fan in the face.
Or, you know, put a veil on it, somehow make it look different.
Right.
Or change the room. Maybe that's not the room. Mm-hmm. To, you know, make out with your partner in or whatever it is. Those are four things you can do. Stop, calm, affirm your present reality, and choose a new response. Mm-hmm. Okay? A lot of times in that moment, there might have been, something that you wished you could have done.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is about our brain is that there's a part of our brain that doesn't know that doesn't understand the difference between fantasy and reality.
Okay.
So when you work with a therapist through you know, the orientation response, like a lot of times when they're attacked or when they're in a car wreck, the natural orientation response, like you see the car coming. So your orientation response is to look over your shoulder at the car, right? Uh-huh. Maybe you didn't get to do that. That's traumatizing, not being able to have that orientation response. Mm-hmm. And then there might have been something that you wish you could have done. Like if it was an attacker, you wish you could have pushed them through a wall, or you wish you could have pushed them into next week.
Mm-hmm.
You know, through therapy, you can act that out. Track your body, have a release. These things are healing.
Retell the story to yourself in a way where you are more empowered, it sounds like.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. While you're tracking your body. Mm-hmm. And it might sound kind of woo-woo, but mm-hmm. this stuff heals. They've done a lot of studies. This works for vets that have been in the war, you know, sexual abuse victims, people that have been in car wrecks, you name it.
It's almost like when you were in an uncomfortable conversation or whatnot, and you wish that you had said something different, and then you're like, oh, I should have said this. You start fantasizing that you did say that and what came out of it. It's almost like you're mm-hmm. trying to empower yourself after mm-hmm. a disempowering experience. I don't know. I'm just trying to, because it's all related in terms of these skills and how we can use them in our lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, sometimes journaling about these things can be helpful. Mm-hmm. You have to, again, get to a point where you can track your body, because I wouldn't recommend journaling about these things to just anybody without a therapist, because it might be that journaling sends them, you know, into a panic attack because they get in touch with something that they're not ready to get in touch with or what have you, you know? So you have to really start tracking your body and notice what's going on with you, to notice what healing methods, whether it's art or writing, are working for you. So I guess, you know, the last thing on my list for just survivors is to relearn touch. You know, there's so many people that have been abused where they just avoid touch.
Mm-hmm.
And that's heartbreaking, because as human beings, we thrive on connection.
Yeah.
We don't do well with isolation. So as soon, you know, and living in isolation just perpetuates the abuse.
Mm-hmm.
So slowly learning non-sexual touch and then slowly branching out is really important to the healing process.
I was coaching someone recently in person. Usually it's over the internet, but this was in person. He had expressed, and I was like, you need to see a therapist for this, but he'd expressed that he'd had abuse in his childhood, not sexual abuse, but where he had withdrawn from people. And he lives an incredibly isolated life. Like he does maybe a few friends, but I checked in with him because he was mainly asking about why people will avoid him and is there something that he's doing. And so we mainly focused on like the type of eye contact he was giving me and his kind of body language. And I was just kind of checking in on those sorts of things. But I was like, you need to like go see some like a therapist. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I asked him, like, do you have much touch in your life? And he was like, oh, no, I don't have any touch. And I'm like, you might, I mean, if you're open to it, you should maybe want to go like a massage, like something non-sexual where you can just, in case you're open to that, because it's healing. And so anyway, at the end of the session, we got up and I'm like, would you like a hug? And he like came up and he gave me like the biggest adorable hug ever. Like, and it was so sweet because he doesn't get to do that. And the fact that there was a safe place where he could just receive a hug, like, it was just, I don't know. I laughed so, like, so big, and it was just a wonderful moment.
Well, that's a beautiful moment. And, done so eloquently, where you had established trust and then you asked. You didn't just go in for the hug. You mm-hmm. asked him. He was able to say yes or no. Mm-hmm. And then he experienced something he probably hadn't experienced in a long time.
Yeah.
That's beautiful. And that's one thing that we need to do as partners or friends or family is always ask. Because if somebody's been sexually abused in any way, they need to be able to say yes or no, And a lot of times they feel like they always have to say yes, and they need to learn that it's okay to say no, mm-hmm.
Things. How do you feel about your list?
I feel like we've covered everything on this page. Let's see. I'm not sure. I think we covered everything for the friends and family.
Okay.
Being supportive. Don't lay on shoulds. Like, you should get over it or you should forgive. A lot of family, they have a tendency to say you need to forgive. And sometimes they're bringing in their religious teachings. They mean well. They really do mean well. Mm-hmm. And they don't realize by foisting their shoulds that feels like the perpetrator again. You're foisting stuff on them, just like the perpetrator foisted stuff mm-hmm. on them. So you need to just, yeah.
It's like that thing with children. I don't know, a guest in the past was talking about how when kids don't want to hug, when all the adults are at a party and the kid comes in, they're shy. And it's like, come on, hug your auntie. And they don't want to. And it's like, force the kid to give physical affection to an mm-hmm. adult and like destroying that kid's sense of boundaries.
Right. Exactly. It's very important. And then the other thing is, I think family and friends, again, they mean well, they want to help. And so they try and fix it, mm-hmm. And you don't need to try and fix it. You can't fix it. All you need to do is love them and be able to hear it and be able to accept it and don't question, and say, I believe you and I'm here to hear your mm-hmm. story. I'm here to support you in any way that I can. Mm-hmm. That's all you need to do.
Right.
Yeah,
it gets complicated with family. I've seen it like firsthand, not in my family, but in people that I have known where it was abuse within siblings.
Mm-hmm.
And then holidays would be really awkward, like after sort of the point where it came out in, mm-hmm. in adulthood that this had happened, and there was I saw the phases of denial and anger and blame and trying to steamroll it as everything's fine now and the resentment. It was just this like ongoing saga. I was like, wow, this is all right. Okay.
And this is why, in a family like that, just like I talked about with the partner and the relationship, it's a relationship matter, it doesn't just reside with a person that was sexually abused. In the example you just gave, it was a family member, a family matter. They need to seek therapy as maybe a family mm-hmm. or at least have some sessions as a mm-hmm. family to allow people to iron out their feelings. So, I'm glad you brought that up because in some cases, being supportive is not enough. You also need to get some therapy for your family, mm-hmm. So.
And the secrets and the, I feel like secrecy is, and like sweeping it under the rug is the worst thing that you can do. Just like, we don't speak of this. Like, it's fine now. Everything's fine.
Yeah. That is so common. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's so important for the family to say, I believe you and I can handle hearing about it, mm-hmm. Because a lot of times the person that has been sexually abused doesn't believe that their family and friends care to know about it. They don't believe that they can handle it. They don't believe that they want to hear it.
If someone's listening to this right now and they are currently in an abusive situation, do you know what they should do, like, to get themselves into a better situation? Like, because I know, like, I'd like to think that everyone is past whatever abuse is happening and now they're listening to this as someone who's just needing to heal, but someone might be in an abusive situation right now listening to this.
Mm-hmm.
What do you tell them?
Well, imagine if they have access to listening to your podcast that they have access to a computer. So if you just type in some keywords like, you know, abuse, safe houses, things like that, you can get in touch with resources that can help get you out of an abusive situation. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's going to be, if you are currently in an abusive situation, then you're in crisis. Mm-hmm. And so again, now we're in crisis mode. So This is about first getting you safe, you know, and you probably want to plan for your leave, right? So once you figure out the safe house that you want to go to, you need to make a little kit for yourself of the things that you want to take the day that you leave, whether it's saving up money, getting your Social Security card, your driver's license, all the little things that you need to gather for the big break, the big escape, mm-hmm. you know, and then connect with that safe house. And the safe house usually... as far as I know, they always protect your identity and where you are and all that, and they'll do their best to keep you safe. Yeah, and honestly, if you can find a way to be connected with a therapist that can guide you through, you know, your leave, mm-hmm. You know, the therapist can help guide you, you know, to talk to you and help you gather an escape plan, mm-hmm. you know, and, you know... And at that point, you can really put together an escape plan that will up your chances of mm-hmm. safety and success.
Okay. Oh, my God, Kate, we did it. Like, we went through so many things. It's so intense. How are you doing?
I think I'm doing good. I'm running through my partner thing and making sure we covered everything. Another thing that I do is visualizations, and I basically create an environment. I always take them, after doing some relaxation, I take them into this field and over this bridge, which is a metaphor of stepping into your unconscious, and then I take them into what I call safe place. And I create experience for them, but it's a loose experience. Like I might say, and your protector animal is approaching you, but I don't mm-hmm. tell them what that protector animal is mm-hmm. or a nurturing figure is approaching you or whatever it is. And then they create their safe place. And then a lot of times they'll start transposing that into their art. And so they start to build the safe world. And that sometimes becomes their first steps into creating a safe world for themselves.
Oh, I love it. I imagined a wolf.
Yeah, wolf is good. Wolf is good. Yeah, so...
Listeners at home, what did you imagine when she said nurturing animal? Protector.
Protector animal. A lot of times people need a protector figure and they need a nurturing figure, mm-hmm. you know? Sometimes a wise one.
Wise one.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, you just reminded me of something it's kind of awkward to say, but like a visual, because... in meditation and lots of things, it's good to have those safe places where you can go in your mind. Mm-hmm. And for me, like hammocks and the beach have always been places, like sort of like a nice tropical environment. One time I was in Honduras mm-hmm. and I was there for a long time. But there was one particular beach we were at while we were doing this little road trip, and we'd stopped at this village and lots of things hadn't gone on, but we'd went down to the beach and I didn't realize, but in Honduras, most of the locals wear bathing suits, but they wear t-shirts over. Like, they're very conservative in how they dress on the beach. And I was just wearing a bikini. And it was getting late, and, like, most of the locals had gone home, and it was just sort of my group. And as we were leaving, I think I was the only one in a bikini at that point, this canoe boat, like, I don't know, it's the ocean, but somehow it was some sort of fisherman canoe, was, like, coming by, and they were, like, hollering out to me, and they were, like... We were just like, oh, hey, and then we were, like, walking away, and, like, they started paddling towards shore, like, toward me.
Wow.
And, like, my whole group was like, we should walk faster. Like, he started. So, yeah. Like, that now in my memory is like Rape Beach, because it was like, they were like, coming for me. And I was like, all right, putting on my clothes. Like,
so that will not be a positive resource for you, that Rape Beach.
Like, so yeah, when you said, like, it should be like, you know, you said your grandmother, like, but if she passed away, maybe not the best memory. It's like, oh, yeah, beach is not that beach. Right, like, not that beach.
Exactly. It can be, and it's funny you bring this up, because a lot of people I work with go through that, and you have to explain to them, just because you had a bad experience at that beach, maybe you can isolate it to a good beach, right, or a good moment, you know, right?
I have plenty of good visuals and good places in my brain and heart to go to, but it just is cracking me up because it was like, not that beach. Anyway.
No, that's a good example.
Where can people, like, what is your website if people want to find out more about you?
My website is just my name, katelurie.com. So that's K-A-T-E, Kate, and Lurie is L-O-R-E-E.
All right, yeah. No, if you're in the LA area especially, Kate is a wonderful resource and a fabulous therapist. I've heard many good things.
Thank you very much. And thank you for having me on the podcast. I really appreciate it, and I value you as a friend and a sex educator, and I just know you're just going to blossom into this powerhouse.
Oh, snap. Get ready. No, thank you. All right. As we like to say, go Team Fun.
Absolutely. Go Team Fun.